Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the voices from leaders of the social design movement throughout the fields of art, architecture, planning, and engineering. I'm your co-host, Eric Hessel, and I'm here with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here with you, Eric, and with John and Emily for the second episode of our conversation.
Picking up from last week, and for our listeners, if you haven't listened to the podcast with John and Emily from last week, we advise you to go to our website at currystonedesignprize.org and give it a listen. It's a fascinating discussion about the evolution of the social design movement over the last 15 years, the subject of equality, both seen through the lens of two extraordinary practices and two great practitioners. This week, we'd like to focus on the future, and I put it to you both. What does the future of the social design movement look like? And I think you can answer that through the lens of your own practices or talk kind of more generally about the field. I know in the case of both of you, Emily beginning with Humble Beginnings in Berkeley County and now moving into a variety of initiatives operating out of Berkeley, I'd be interested to hear, you know, what's next, what's moving forward, how does the current programming of Project H fit along a timeline. And John, in lieu of, you know, having founded and run public architecture for 15 years and now moving into this position with the Loeb Fellowship, you know, what do you see as the next 10 years looking like?
What happens in the future with the profession or maybe more broadly, the role of the design of the built environment and its ability to positively improve social outcomes? I think it's unclear because no one knows the future, but it's hard for me to imagine that there isn't going to be a recognition of the opportunity and value of the built environment around social impact and social outcomes. Whether or not designers will embrace that or will play a significant role, I think, is still to be seen. I mean, I certainly believe that's going to be the case. There's going to be a lot of bumpiness along the way. You know, there's always loss. There's always a lack of interest in the craft of making buildings or making environments. The tensions now on larger issues, whether that's how the computer can be used to generate form or how we're looking at these larger social outcomes. I think that the craft of placemaking, we're seeing less interest in that at the moment or less attention to it. And I think that there's going to be a reaction to that. I'm guessing that there's going to be a wave of young professionals and others who will focus on craft again. And that's not a bad thing. I just think we're going to see this push and pull. And that doesn't mean that craft can't be in service of social outcomes. But if we look at the past, the lessons would be that we're going to see it change over time. I'm hoping that unlike what we saw in the 80s, 90s, where I think that there was really a pullback from social engagement, and it was only held by a few within the profession, I hope, and I believe this is true, that we're not going to see the kind of pullback that we saw after, you know, late 1970s or early 80s, that it's going to still reside with us because I think the value, the relevance to the profession, the relevance to the people we serve is too great.
I'm not a youngin' anymore, but I'm also not of the old guard. I mentioned that because Project H was sort of born at what was a beginning of a conversation that grew very quickly. And it's been really fun and exciting and tough and a constant question and critique about whether we're doing the right work or not and how. And so I think when I look to the future, it's hard for me to disconnect the future with what has happened both in my own career and then also as a sort of greater movement. People like John Peterson and Tom Fisher, and there are so many amazing folks who are working at a level that I don't reach that are asking questions of the entire profession. Like, how do we integrate public interest into architecture and design in the same way that medicine or law does, where it's not something that people have to go outside of their day job to go and volunteer and do? If I have a pipe dream for the profession of architecture and design, it's that we no longer have to start brand new nonprofits I mean, that should still happen, but that we don't have to. We don't have to go and find some organization to volunteer for in order to do this type of work. It should be far more integrated into all practices. And John and public architecture have made such huge strides in exactly that. And I think that that will continue. And then the other thing I would say is, this is obviously my own bias, but having worked with so many young people, and I would say specifically young people who identify as something very specific, for example, a recent immigrant or a young girl of color or a transgender or whatever the thing is that they deeply, deeply identify with, I also hope that design as a process and as a community activity becomes more accessible and embraced by very specific groups. So I'm saying that also because I've observed and I'm deeply committed to the power of that with young girls. And I know that when you create spaces that are dedicated to a specific group that has been marginalized or underestimated for whatever reason and for however long, and giving tools that are creative or literal, like power tools and construction, that is hugely, hugely transformative. And you can't do that all the time in a broad group that doesn't have that shared identity. So I would also hope that in the future, we also start to specialize a little bit, that we can have these subcategories of social design, that it's not just social impact design is this great umbrella, but there are so many things underneath that that mean something specific to a specific group of people. I think that's actually where the really deep and long-term impact can happen.
So what I find fascinating is that we're talking largely about the role of designers. And I think that what happened in the neoliberal era is that things change dramatically. If we look at the transcript and the documentation on modern architecture, there was a huge discussion on how people should live together, how people should interact, how society should be formed by making a city. Nowadays, the architect is more and more expected to maximize profit through doing a design that is attractive, which is it's a dramatic shift. But I think this is quite interesting because it is actually it relates to something that you both practices do very well, that is trying to inform both designers and people that are not designers what design could actually do. So I find fascinating how the work of Emily brings students to meet their own communities and to understand which are the issues of this community. So it's a kind of investigation that helps young citizens become informed of what design could actually bring to this community. Well, I think that also the work of public architecture is not only a work that is providing a service, but it's also a work that is showing to a larger crowd what design could actually be about. So establishing connection and becoming also a communication tool.
That's absolutely right. Positive work doesn't happen without an engaged client and a client that is in part educated, though that's, I think, a loaded idea. One has to be careful about that. But yeah, we're not going to do this. We can't just slather on more professional designers and expect there to be a better world. There has to be an understanding about the value of the environment that we're in. And actually, I would step outside of what we often hear is the value of design. I actually think that's a danger. I think design has a much more limited value. What has a tremendous value and power is the built environment or the environment generally, but we have lesser control over the natural environment, although some would argue there is no natural environment that remains. It's all a built environment, depending on how you look at it. But we can foster the built environment. And it's that fostering, that craft that makes design powerful. It is the environment that makes it powerful, not the other way around.
So one theme that seems to emerge is, you know, perhaps looking at the next 10 or 15 years, we're not just changing the environment, but changing the way people feel about it. Emily, specific to your work, you know, I think one of the reasons it's always been so laudable is that, you know, you want to change the way people think. You know, engaging them early is certainly important and critical. Architecture is notorious for, you know, being a white male profession and being exclusionary. How does the world start to look different when we're introducing an appreciation for a capacity and an enthusiasm, a passion for the built environment, for craft, for building, for design towards a younger generation? I mean, what is your vision for, you know, what some of your students are going to be doing when they're 30 or 40?
I don't have like a deep desire that they all become architects. I think some of them may. That's certainly not the goal. Like, I feel very lucky to get to work with so many amazing young people. I'm like living vicariously through them. But I think my biggest goal for them is they just get to grow up and do whatever they want, that they have the tools and the confidence to never feel like there's something out of reach. That doesn't matter where you come from or what gender you are or race or whatever. If you want to be a doctor, you can be a doctor. And if you want to be an architect, you can be an architect. And that sounds like so simple, but I think that some of the power of design and building for a young person is seeing your own two hands create something that is bigger than you. And that is such an important metaphor for a young person to experience. I didn't have that experience as a young person. I did love to build stuff, but I never felt like, oh, I just built a tiny home or a farmer's market. Therefore, I can go do this equally amazing, huge thing in my life. I found that over many years. I feel that way now, but I didn't have the opportunity to do that through building. And so I've seen that happen with some of my students who are now graduated from college as, you know, the first people in their families to go to college. I see that in my 10-year-old girls who leave like, I just fused metal. Don't you dare tell me I can't do anything else. I think it's that. It's that sense of like walking around with an optimistic chip on your shoulder. I'll call it that. I think John is absolutely right that to use the phrase power of design is, there's some asterisks that come along with it, but definitely the power of the built environment. And I was just last week, I was invited to the White House of all places with this group of makerspace organizers from all around the country talking about how and why we should have more makerspaces for communities and for schools. There was a lot of conversation about what should be in these makerspaces, who should be running them, how they should be run, et cetera. And I kept thinking that to me, it's not so much about the tools you fill these spaces with, but actually that these spaces are spaces in the first place. Just by putting up four walls and saying this space belongs to you, that is the best gift that you can give to any person or community, that you have a space that's yours to make into something. I just finished this book by Sandra Cisneros. It's her memoir. It's a collection of essays called A House of My Own. She talks about exactly that, the power of space and ownership. So I think about it in that way for young people too. Young people go through their lives and they go to school and they go home and none of those spaces really feel like them, like they belong to them. Saying to a young person, not only are we going to make a space, but this space is going to be yours. What better gift can you give and what better thing can you do as a designer and a builder but to help co-create that? I'll just say lastly that, you know, in the creation of this brand new space that we're opening, Girls Garage, I have also felt that way. Like, this is a space that is mine. It's mine and it belongs to our girls. And we can put whatever we want on the walls and we could tear down the walls if we want. And there's an authorship and an ownership that means we get to create our own world. And that means so much to me. As you said, being a woman and a woman of color in architecture, that means something to me. I also know that means something to every girl that walks in the door.
Thank you, Emily. With this answer, you just implanted me as well with an optimistic chip. We're taking a short pause now, but we will be back soon with Emily Piliton and John Peterson to talk more about the transformative power of the built environment. This program was brought to you by the Curry Stone Design Prize. You can find updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more information on our winners on currystonedesignprize.com. Stay with us. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. This month, we are addressing the question, can design challenge inequality? In this episode, we have been discussing with Emily Piliton and with John Peterson about the future of social design, seen through the lenses of their practices and their work. While in the following episode, we will be speaking with Giancarlo Mazzanti from Colombia, with the collective Al Borde from Ecuador, and with Active Social Architecture in Rwanda, in order to draw an international observatory on how design is confronting inequality. But back to our conversation. Emily, you were talking about the power of space and how authorship can lead to ownership. Could you tell us a bit more about the Girls Garage project that you're running in Berkeley? It would be interesting to understand better, how does it connect to a local community? Is it a public space or is it a working space? And what are the issues that you're facing?
Girls Garage is this 3,600 square feet. We're just opening it up. The program has actually been running for 4 years, but we're moving into the space that is dedicated only to Girls Garage. It was born out of an observation in the Studio H high school program, my observation of seeing how the female students would interact with me and with other girls, other female students, versus in the co-ed space and in a space like a construction site that is historically predominantly male. So Girls Garage is intended for younger girls. It's ages 9 through 13. We do everything from carpentry to welding and masonry and electronics and graphic design and laser etching. And we make skateboards and we build dog houses and real architecture. But we also work in deep partnership with local organizations. One of our biggest partners is the Women's Daytime Drop-In Center, which is a center for homeless and abused women to receive free services and short-term residential housing. Every year we build 4 to 10 pieces of furniture for them. And some of the girls that attend actually live there. That is a big part of it. I'm not a vocational school. We're not in the business of like training hundreds of girls to become professional welders. They may do that. But more importantly, I think it's a space for girls to feel welcome to do the things that maybe they've been told not to, and more importantly, to do those things with some sense of meaning to themselves and then to something beyond just us, for a community, for someone down the street. We don't often build things that we take home and give to our moms. You know, I had this idea that some girls would say, like, I don't want to give it away, I want to keep it. And we've never heard that. They often say that's the best part, is that they're building something for someone else, and that makes it more meaningful, and it means that they want to do a great job. And obviously there's a connection to STEM learning and all of these things that are part of public education and are also very important. But I have girls that come in at age 9 afraid to do a lot of things, and they leave at age 13, and I would not get in their way. I'll put it that way.
So, John, we know that this year you have been teaching a course at the GSD that is titled An Unsentimental Look at Architecture and Social Craft, that somehow is also reflecting on many of the issues that we have been discussing today. But what is actually the field of inquiry of this course?
It sort of faces a topic that I've felt strongly about, but there's never been anything that I've had an opportunity to really address. Many of us talk about social impact within our work, but I'm frustrated with the fact that we all are struggling with what that means. And no one's at fault here. It's simply that we haven't had an opportunity yet to really share what that means and collectively understand that what is it that we mean when we talk about social impact, or what is it, what's the breadth of what we mean? Because I don't think we're a long way away from being able to point at a crafted sentence to say what that is. So the course is structured to really understand intent. So imagine all the things that we think are urgent, right? Like, how do we measure social outcomes? How do we get better social outcomes? And where do we discover those areas where we can have impact? But even before that, what do we intend? What's our intent as designers? So I'm really going back, in a sense, to this very emergent question, but I feel like we need to understand that if we're going to go forward and answer those more urgent issues, like how do we measure this? You know, how do we measure the work that we're doing? You know, I'm in this extraordinary institution with an opportunity to debate that question in conversation. So one of the assumptions is that we can't look to text to tell us what it is our intent when we use this language. We can't turn to text. We can only turn in conversation to others. So the idea was to, one, select who are actors in this area of thinking, and then can we craft dialogue with that person and call out what is truly interesting or innovative or helps to really set where our intentions are? And then can we use that dialogue as the product. So I'm very interested in new ways of thinking about educating and new ways of thinking about learning and the products of conversation. You know, we are all exposed, and you know, here we are doing it right now in a podcast form where we're using conversation as a way of pushing ideas and thinking forward. And so can we do that in academia? And so literally there's a series of conversations, and those are recorded, both audio and video, and then those are crafted into a series of short videos that hopefully will begin to set in motion maybe some greater clarity about what we mean, what do we intend. So it's a long answer to your question, but that's sort of something that's been itching at me ever since, you know, I started on this path, and now I have this opportunity to actually play that out.
How realistic is it that we get to a point where, you know, social agendas are once again, you know, in front of every architecture curricula, that they do become a part of everyday practice? As you put it in an earlier question, we think about social agency the way we think about structure. You know, it's just sort of a foregone conclusion. Is that within the reach of this next generation? Emily, feel free to weigh in as well.
I actually believe it is. And I don't want to be Pollyannic about this. And I, you know, at heart, a large part of my heart beats as a skeptic, but I do actually think that's achievable. Now, whether or not we'll do that in this, the generation that's in school now or just coming out or about to enter, it's going to take a few generations to turn that one over. I mean, we'll see, but I tend to believe that the value is so great that our clients will ask for it as they ask for buildings to not fall down on top of them. And as we get more skilled at it, as we're very skilled at keeping buildings from falling down on people, very skilled at it, I think that that's where this is going. And I think in some ways it's going to be a great thing for the profession moving forward. And so, but we'll see.
I love what John said about, you know, what do you do with these mundane projects and how do those also become socially oriented at the very least? And I think for me, it's exciting to talk to young designers who I'm teaching this seminar class at UC Berkeley with 24, like third and fourth year architecture students. And it just started this past week. And I said to them, look, I'm not going to turn you into a social designer. I just want you to ask good questions and to go about your professional work as a good person. And I think it's that. It's everything can be a socially impactful and important and authentic project if we're asking the right questions and if we're walking into spaces with a mindset of learning and of, yes, bringing our expertise, but doing that from a place of authenticity and humility. I think in that way, really any project that we are willing to take on, we can and should be having a dialogue about what it means for people and a greater context. I'm also incredibly skeptical and kind of a crank about a lot of things, but I feel really optimistic, especially when I walk into a class or a lecture hall filled with 20-year-olds and every single one of them is there because that's what they want to do. That's amazing. That's amazing. I think it's actually rarer to find an undergraduate architecture student who doesn't want anything to do with it. I have yet to meet that person in the past 4 or 5 years. Thank you so much for hosting it.
Yeah, delighted to be here. It's a great pleasure.
That's a powerful image, Emily, and I think encouraging to all of us to think that among the millennial set, there's more interest in social design than not. We've run out of time, but we'd like to thank both of our guests, John Peterson and Emily Pilliton, for taking time out of their busy practices to share with us some of their lessons learned and their plans for the future. We hope that our listeners have taken away a little bit of inspiration and are busy formulating their own plans for the next 15 years.
Emily, John, once more, thank you very much for sharing with us insights about your work and about your larger vision on public interest design. I think this conversation exposes well the great potential that our societies have, if just we can take into serious consideration the impact that citizens can have on their environment, not only through buildings, but also through the awareness of social justice, equity, and ecology. Seeing the 100 honorees that the Curry Stone Design Prize is recognizing this year, hope arises that change will come from a spread consciousness of citizens' direct involvement and participation. We're closing here, but please have a look at our website, currystonedesignprize.com, for further information about our speakers and the prize honorees. For all the latest news on social design insights, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Have a great day, and take action now!